And we welcome back Asia correspondent Ed White from Seoul. Ed, good morning and welcome.
Oh, good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Really good, thank you. These tensions between the United States and China are flaring up again.
Yes. I mean, if you go back over the 4 years of the Trump presidency, relations between the US and China had really soured across a number of fronts. The Trump administration had taken a much tougher line with Beijing, whether it was the US-led trade war, the pressure on Chinese technology companies like Huawei, the US support for Taiwan and its defense, the retention of democracy and rule of law in Hong Kong, and also this greater attention and pressure over the internment and surveillance of Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. At the same time, under Xi Jinping, China's president, there has been a definite hardening in its response to these criticisms. It fought back very hard on the trade issue. Obviously, when it came to Huawei, Beijing was again very tough, and it tightened its grip further on Hong Kong. It's had these increasingly aggressive and frequent military activities around Taiwan. And then with Xinjiang, the government in China has also obviously sternly denied the extent and the severity of this mass internment campaign. And so with all of this happening over the last few years, not to mention the global pandemic, which is going to require a lot of global cooperation, many people in Asia and around the world really had been waiting and watching closely as to what the Biden administration would take on, would do on these issues, and whether the relationship might actually improve under a potentially more stable White House. What we've seen so far, though, from the Biden team is really no significant shift or backtrack on these key issues. There has, of course, been a change in tone, a return to a more sort of diplomatic language. But across a number of these issues, the US has, over recent weeks, really only looked to step up pressure on Beijing. So in response to the situation in Xinjiang, we've seen the US State Department accuse China of committing genocide and crimes against humanity. And in a recent human rights report, there has been coordinated sanctions with the US, the EU, the UK and Canada and other countries targeting Chinese security officials that have been, they believe, involved in the involved in Xinjiang. Last week, the Biden administration also floated the idea of a potential boycott of next year's Winter Olympics, which is being hosted by Beijing. On Hong Kong, the Biden administration has been accusing very high-ranking Chinese and Hong Kong officials over actions that it says is reducing Hong Kong's high degree of autonomy. And on Taiwan, there were moves that really gathered pace towards the end of the Trump presidency to allow for the government in Taipei to have more diplomatic space, things like access to higher-level meetings, international organizations. These moves have also continued under Biden. And I think more concern also raised by top State Department and military officials just over Chinese military aggression towards the government in Taipei. And so, you know, taken together, I think Biden has made it fairly clear that under his presidency, he will continue to hold China to account over what the US, you know, now just sees as human rights abuses, as well as these unfair economic practices.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because when you look at the leadership change, we've seen President Xi in recent years become much more assertive and aggressive, to use polite terms, on numerous fronts in asserting China's presence and in the crackdown, as you said, in particular on the Uyghurs. Then we had a president of the United States who had his own particular personality and style. I don't know if you recall the so-called madman theory that was attributed to President Nixon's early term, where you want to present a level of unpredictability and volatility to keep your international counterparts wondering what the hell you might do next. With President Biden, there certainly might be more predictability, but was anyone ever expecting there would be a backing down on some of these really fundamental issues?
Well, I think what has become clear and what wasn't quite known towards the end of the Trump presidency is that the degree of bipartisan support and also just how popular this kind of stance is in the US to be, for want of a better term, kind of anti-China. And so what has changed is that Trump saw, you know, China as basically something that he could attack and it would work well for him domestically. With Biden, there's a greater degree of understanding and a degree that they are now saying we see China as, you know, both a competitor and someone we can cooperate with. But at a political level in the US, nothing's really changed because both Republicans and the Democrats see this issue in essentially the same light, in that they are now very, very firm on needing to protect US interests.
Who are the Wolf Warrior diplomats so named?
Well, this is, so when we're asking about what China's response is, for instance, when the top diplomats from the US and China met in Alaska last month, the Chinese side was very stern, showing no signs of a softer approach and basically continuing this trend, which has now become known as wolf warrior diplomacy. This term stems actually from a sort of nationalistic film series. I guess you could call it a Chinese version of Rambo. Basically, it describes an increasingly hostile and aggressive approach taken by China's foreign diplomats in response to what they see as basically a Western campaign against China. And so if we go back to those sanctions, for instance, that were imposed by the US and others over Xinjiang, Beijing immediately retaliated with counter-sanctions targeting officials from Europe. You're talking about parliamentarians from Europe and the UK as well as in Canada. It also looks like they are now going to hit out at the trade deal between the EU and China, and this was an agreement that took about 7 years to broker and finally agreed to last year. That is now looking very shaky. They are also sort of fanning the flames of nationalism in China, so pressure has risen sharply on Western companies operating in China. Again, something that we did see more of during the Trump years, but state-run Chinese media backed by these foreign diplomats that are speaking out very publicly, they are targeting, they are sort of making, brewing this Chinese nationalistic sentiment and patriotism to orchestrate boycotts of well-known Western clothing brands. So recently we've seen H&M, Nike, Adidas and Burberry all targeted by both Chinese state media and domestic sort of netizens in China. And I think a quote from one former senior Chinese diplomat, which possibly just sums up the attitude, is that the Chinese leaders believe that they have momentum and time is on their side and nothing can stop their rise. And so one just final very important domestic context for all of this and what to, in terms of what's happening in China. This year, just a few months' time, the Chinese Communist Party will celebrate 100 years since its founding. This is seen as an event of huge domestic importance. Many Chinese watchers and experts believe that the party will be extremely focused on projecting strength, demonstrating its achievements for the Chinese people. And so when we step back and think about the tension and the challenges that are rising on the global level, given that domestic context in China and also given the approach that Biden has taken, it's very difficult to see how the US and China will be able to work together.
Just a couple of minutes left to look what's happening in India. We know that the virus is unfortunately going gangbusters there at the moment. In fact, to the extent that New Zealand has stopped flights coming in from India temporarily. But what is happening with immunisation?
Yeah, so I mean, the numbers have just overnight, I think the last tally I saw, that daily cases there are up to about 200,000 people a day. So that's, you know, close to the population of Wellington City. And that's a doubling of cases over the last 2 weeks, I think up tenfold since the start of the year. The focus is obviously returning to social distancing, potential return to the tough lockdowns that they had last year, and obviously a redoubling of efforts to speed up the vaccination rates. They have India has delivered about 120 million jabs, so that's in raw numbers that compares to about 40 million in the UK and 180 million in the US. But if you look at sort of per capita, so jabs per 100 people, that's fewer than 10 doses, whereas the US and the UK are up to around 60 jabs per 100 people, so there's a long way to go. India actually is a major producer of vaccines, but of course a lot of these are under contract and have to be exported. So what the government is now doing is basically trying to loosen all the restrictions that they have for drug regulators. And so earlier this week, they have granted, I think, emergency approval to the Russian Sputnik vaccine. And they, I think, said that they would do this for basically any other foreign vaccines that had been approved elsewhere. So essentially taking away their domestic regulatory arm for vaccines and just doing anything that they can to speed them up. The problem is, of course, that vaccine supplies are tight everywhere. So moves like this don't actually guarantee an uptick. And forecasts, obviously, with the coronavirus is always fairly loose. But it will take at least several weeks at the earliest to see any benefit from these measures, be it a speed up in the vaccines or indeed lockdowns. And in the meantime, the forecasts are that the death rate of this new wave will probably peak later this month or even in early May. So fairly grim situation.
Thank you, Ed. Much appreciated. Ed White is a correspondent for the Financial Times based in Seoul.